Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm your host, and with me are my very dear friends all aboard, Pamela Chaddock, Marvin Garin, Chuck Thurston, and Andre Rodatis. Hi, you guys.
Yay. Hi.
Good morning,
everybody. Hi, Paula.
Good
morning. Dun-da-da-da.
Dun-da-da-da.
Yay.
Yeah. Gotta get some trumpets on here.
Not just fair weather friends.
Yeah. I guess it's raining in the Pacific Northwest pretty heavily, but it's beautiful here in Colorado. So Andre and Pam are both in the Pacific Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
But,
another day for me.
Yeah.
What's Nevada like, Marvin? Is it clear and bright out there?
You know, we've had some cloudy weather, which is really unusual for us the last few days, but today it's nice and bright and sunny and cool, I'd say, in the high 40s so far.
Ooh, so nice. Yeah. Nice walking around weather.
Yeah, yeah.
So I want to give a shout-out to our dear friend God's Gumshoe, who has been a longtime friend of the Cosmic Citizen and used to actually do a worship every Sunday for quite a while. And he's on the board today, so welcome.
It's wonderful.
We affectionately call him Gigi.
Yeah.
Welcome, Gumshoe. It's so good to see you pop up. Wow. And Gary and Isadora and all of our dear friends. Pam is on the board as well. Welcome to all of you guys.
Mm-hmm.
So we are on the third part of paper 8, which is the infinite spirit, the third person of the Trinity. And we're on section 3 today, Relation of the Spirit to the Father and the Son. This will be a great study, I think. I'm really looking forward to it. Tonight.
Yes.
I said it before, I love studying with you guys, so thank you all for being here. And, really a sublime experience. But any thoughts on this paper so far, or what we've covered so far? I mean, we started at the behest of Gina Lassiter, we started with paper 1, Universal Father. What a novel concept. And we've just kept going. You know, we did the first five on the Father, and then we did the Eternal Son. We read about the Eternal Son, and now we're off to the Infinite Spirit and fully into that. So it's a marvelous exploration of the first part of the book.
Yeah. You know, I just share one thought. It's occurred to me a while back, in a sense, one of the main fields in philosophy is called systematic theology, which is, I can't remember how that was coined, but one of the great theologians, Theologus, Summa Theologia or something. One of you might know what it is.
Summa Theologica.
Might have been, yeah. Is that Augustine?
Yeah,
no, I
believe so.
Augustine or Thomas Aquinas, and anyway,
Aquinas.
Aquinas. There you go.
Sort of established this idea that you know, they're the greatest theological thinkers put out this compendium that is like sort of covers everything that is fundamental and everything in kind of theological reality. And it strikes me that the first 10 papers in the Urantia book are the systematic theology that they're presenting to us, the nature of deity, how God happened, the relationships between the Trinity and relationship to the universe, to the whole cosmos, and the foundations of all reality is what they put out. It's amazing stuff, really. Amazing stuff.
It is truly foundational. Oh, you're absolutely right.
Oh, it is. Yes, I've been rereading one of my favorite books, A Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe. Mathematical Archetypes. It's by Michael Schneider. And so because we're discussing the Trinity, you know, I started reading about number three, and the number is so foundational, and I know we'll get into this as we read the paper, but it's like he describes one and two were considered by the ancient mathematical philosophers to be the parents of numbers, with three the first newborn number, the first and eldest number, which created the Greek triad, you know, the triangle. So there's so many facets to it because it's so foundational, you know, like you were saying, Marvin, things like three implies wholeness, strength, stability, and process. It's like, you know, when the Son and the Spirit come together, they create the process of going out into the universe and bringing us back to paradise. So there's just so many aspects to understanding Trinity that I'm really excited about this paper because of all the interesting thing I want to say. One interesting thing about this, a triad, you know, as a triangle. And ancient Egyptians were the ones that were against walking under a ladder because don't break the triangle. Don't disturb a complete event. So it's fun to get some background on these things that we've heard for, you know, eons and where they originated. So, and it comes back to the Trinity. So much comes back to the Trinity. So anyway.
There's great strength in that. Just one to add on to what Pam was saying there from, I also love that book, The Beginner's Guide. And one of the things about three, you notice right away, is that you can make a three-legged stool.
Yes.
Like that, the three legs. That's the minimum kind of structural stability. And, you know, you see that in the hexagonal shape. You like beehives and things like that. And trusses and construction. You know, we have triangular trusses. There's great strength in triangles. Oh, that's interesting, though, about the Egyptians. I hadn't heard that. I don't remember that part.
Yeah, you know, the the other thing is, you know, I've kind of shared with this with you guys before, but for me, this is so, I don't know, it's so fundamental that I feel it in my bones. And I think it's the word paradigmatic, you know, it's paradigm for all of the relationships in the creation. I think family is the paradigmatic set of relationships. So what's interesting to me is that, you know, in the biblical account, it said, I think what's the first act? God acted and God created light, if I'm remembering correctly. But in the Orange book, there's this state of the divine. I don't know what else to call it because they don't use the word deity until the divine personalizes in some sense. So there's this the state of the divine that they call the I am. Right, it's an existential state. It's the state of reality and deity before God manifested in any way. So there was no quality to God, to divinity at that point, to deity. There was nothing had been done. Right, it was just all potential waiting to happen. Right, and there was sort of a form of pre-will. Because there had been no act. No act had been taken. And the first act, and they describe this as really simultaneous. For us, they describe it as sequential, but they say it's always been this way, and it always will be this way, that the first manifesting of deity's will was to become a creator of a created being, and for the two of them to become co-creators of a third being. And so in a flash, in an instant, all of the fundamental vectors of relationship in family come into being. Parent, child, and co-fraternal relations between siblings and their relationship back to the fundamental creator and the relationships of mother and father, paternal and maternal creators. All of that is endemic in that very first act. And then from that, every other relationship between persons flows in all of creation. Mm-hmm. So it's like the first act of deity is to become persons in relationship to each other. Mm-hmm. And I can't say how important that is to me. You know, what's going on in the universe, I like to think of it sometimes as a stage play, and there's the play, there's the dialogue, and there's the stage and the furniture on the stage, all the props, which is all of the physical reality and the ideational reality. But the fundamental thing that's going on in the cosmos is about persons and relationships. The rest, I think.
So let me ask you this, Marvin.
Backdrop.
And yes. Everyone, without relationship, does love exist?
Oh, I don't think so.
I don't think so.
I think love, that's exactly right. You know, fundamental realities exist only in a personal cosmos, an interpersonal cosmos. Because
love is only expressed between persons. I mean, it only exists because there's a relationship between persons.
Exactly.
Yes.
That's the place where love, that's like the loom that love is woven on.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Pam.
Yeah, I think that comes out in this section that we're going to be reading. You know, the all-loving Father and the all-loving Father and the all-merciful Son have the project of drawing to themselves all truth-loving souls. So it's like the... all-loving Father, all-merciful Son. So, yes, love to me must be a part of the initial I am. In other words, that's the substance from which everything comes from.
Yes.
That's the way I see it.
Yeah. We're getting a little bit
of that, but you're right, Paula. You know, I think love existed only in potential in the I am because there wasn't anyone to love. You could say the I am loved itself, but that's sort of almost a non sequitur. You know, love is something that exists between persons. I think you're onto something there, Paula. Yeah,
it's outgoing.
But there's another wrinkle. Because all potentials are actuals in eternity.
Right.
Oh, ho, on the absolute level. So now what do you have to say about that? Huh?
A wrinkle in time.
So that means love always did exist, even in the I am. Oh, because there is no sequence. Oh.
There you go.
Right. But love is expressed in relationship. And so, and, you know, you're right, though. That's one of those wrinkles that makes our head break.
Isn't it good to be human?
As they expressed to us last time we read. we try to give you
well,
guys
great
a starting
to be human,
point
isn't
because
it?
You need it. Yeah, exactly.
And there was no such thing as relationship. Relationship didn't exist at that theoretical state.
Yeah.
Theoretical.
Well, here's the
yeah.
If I could just share something really quick. I think it's a set us up for what we're about to read, maybe. But for some reason, I'd never noticed not just this paragraph, but a certain phrase at the end of this paragraph, which I think is, I don't know, one of those Urantia book formulations of language where you just have to go, wow. Anyway, this is in paper 104, section 3, paragraph 14. This whole paper is about the Trinity concept, so it's kind of what we're talking about.
Oh, yeah. True.
But anyway, I'm just picking up in the second sentence here. It says, personality seeks other personality association, an absolute, as well as on all other levels. So right there, it's like, oh, that's the birth of relationship, personality association. And the association of the three paradise personalities eternalizes the first by unity. The personality union of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. We're not talking about the Trinity. This is something else. This is the first triunity. For when these three persons, as persons, conjoin for united function, they thereby constitute a triunity of functional unity. Not a Trinity. It's an organic entity. But nonetheless, and this is the part I love, nonetheless a Trinity, a threefold functional aggregate unanimity.
Wow.
Threefold functional aggregate unanimity. So
wow.
They're all three agreeing, but as persons, which is different from the Trinity. That's a, yeah.
So does
well,
that
say
mean
Trinity
function
is not a triunity. Is not a functional unanimity, divided and indivisible deity. So that's.
So,
so the Trinity
not,
is not a person. Yeah.
Go ahead, Pam.
I'm trying to say, what is that statement? Form follows function?
Yeah,
yes.
Right.
Well,
right.
But it's like. Form is interwoven with function, is what we're saying here. Because it's the aggregate unanimity. It's undivisible.
In a triunity, you know, the three persons are very clear and separate and different. But they're all in perfect agreement. So they retain their personality. I mean, they're talking about a personality relationship. That's why I brought this up, because it kind
of
flows into what we're going to be reading. Triunity is a function, is a personality, is a three-way personality relationship, whereas the Trinity is something else. Yeah.
Well, the Trinity, I guess, just refers to the original sources and centers, you know, always, I think.
Joined in this other kind of functional unity.
Right.
So I guess it's not, I mean, the Trinity is not personal. The Trinity is not a person, let's say.
Oh, right. Yeah, someone once told me there is no one, there's only three. And that was a real intriguing statement to me.
Yeah, that's
but
the first real number.
Our good friend, Steve McIntosh, years ago created the triad cards. I don't know if you guys remember that. It was a whole deck
of different
triads.
I worked on those.
You did? Do you still have a set of them?
I got a couple of decks. Yeah, remember we always used to get together with Steve's after study group and storm about triads?
Salon. Right.
Oh, wow.
Man, I would love to. You know, those are pretty hard to find these days, but they really made you think about the wholeness of any concept, you know, so whether it was body, mind, spirit, thought, word, deed, father, mother, child, you know, that all the Trinity concepts that the Arantia book gives us, all of the triads, let's say, that, and then you start to see a more function in those things, you know. Origin, history, destiny. And when I think of it now, I think of all three. I don't just think of one, because they all three matter so much, right? The triad, all of the triads create wholeness. Whatever it is, it creates a wholeness in our concept. I love taking those triads and saying, okay, this one represents the Father, this represents the Son, you know, just kind of picking them apart and exploring each one, each aspect of it. But, yeah, that's neither here nor there, I guess. But
what do you mean neither here nor
there?
It's the whole thing. It's everything.
It's both.
It's not neither here nor there. Of course it isn't. It's everywhere.
It's here, there, and everywhere.
That's right. So beware.
It's both plus one.
Yeah.
The universal enchilada.
The universal enchilada.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah, you start thinking.
Well, having covered
that,
we're ready to read.
I guess
I can
so.
Tell we're ready to read.
Yeah. We can't descend any lower, you know, so we gotta start reading.
Yeah.
We have to be present now. So who would like to read this?
Go ahead, Andre. I'll do it another time. Go ahead.
Nature of the Infinite Spirit, is that where we are?
No. Relation of the Spirit to the Father and the Son.
Relation of the Spirit to the Father and the Son. Okay, very good. Thank you. As the Eternal Son is the word expression of the first, absolute and infinite thought of the universal Father, so the conjoint actor is the perfect execution of the first completed creative concept or plan for combined action by the Father-Son personality partnership of absolute thought-word union. The third source and center eternalizes concurrently with the central or fiat creation, and only this central creation is external. Is eternal in existence among universes. Since the personalization of the third source, the first source no more personally participates in universe creation. Let me read that again just because of the sense. Since the personalization of the third source, the first source no more personally participates in universe creation. The Universal Father delegates everything possible to his Eternal Son. Likewise, does the Eternal Son bestow all possible authority and power upon the conjoint Creator. The Eternal Son and the conjoint Creator have, as partners and through their coordinate personalities, planned and fashioned every post-Havona universe which has been brought into existence. The Spirit sustains the same personal relation to the Son in all subsequent creation that the Son sustains to the Father in the first and central creation. A Creator Son of the Eternal Son and a Creative Spirit of the Infinite Spirit created you and your universe. And while the Father in faithfulness upholds that which they have organized, it devolves upon this universe Son and this universe Spirit to foster and sustain their work, as well as to minister to the creatures of their own making.
Uh-oh, Andre dropped off.
Yeah.
He'll be back. His phone dies, which is drives you nuts. But, yeah, I just told the show to continue. So go ahead, Marvin. Keep going with where he left off.
So which paragraph was it? I was listening, but I wasn't watching.
It was 4, and he ended with creatures of their own making.
Okay. Why don't I just read that again? A creator son of the eternal son and a creative spirit of the infinite spirit created you and your universe. And while the Father in faithfulness upholds that which they have organized, it devolves upon this universe son and this universe spirit to foster and sustain their work as well as to minister to the creatures of their own making. The infinite spirit is the effective agent of the all-loving Father and the all-merciful Son for the execution of their conjoint project of drawing to themselves all truth-loving souls on all the worlds of time and space. The very instant the Eternal Son accepted his Father's plan of perfection attainment for the creatures of the universes, the moment the Ascension Project became a Father-Son plan, that instant the Infinite Spirit became the conjoint administrator of the Father and the Son for the execution of their united and eternal purpose. And in so doing, the Infinite Spirit pledged all his resources of divine presence and of spirit personalities to the Father and the Son. He has dedicated all to the stupendous plan of exalting surviving will creatures to the divine heights of paradise perfection. The Infinite Spirit is a complete, exclusive, and universal revelation of the Universal Father and his Eternal Son. All knowledge of the Father-Son partnership must be had through the Infinite Spirit, the conjoint representative of the divine thought-word union. You know, I might ask that folks mute. We're getting a fair bit of background stuff. The Eternal Son is the only avenue of approach. The Eternal Son is the only avenue of approach to the Universal Father, and the Infinite Spirit is the only means of attaining the Eternal Son. Only by the patient ministry of the Spirit are the ascendant beings of time able to discover the Son. That's an interesting statement. Only by the patient ministry of the Spirit are the ascendant beings of time able to discover the Son. At the center of all things, the Infinite Spirit is the first of the paradise deities to be attained by the ascending pilgrims. The third person enshrouds the second and the first persons, and therefore must always be recognized by all who are candidates for presentation to the Son and his Father. And in many other ways does the Spirit equally represent and similarly serve the Father and the Son.
And that
well,
last sentence
that
of 8, yeah, we're sorry you
dropped
off.
Yeah, I appreciate
off.
That. Apparently the universe wanted to kick me off and have Marvin read. So God bless you, Brother Marvin.
Yeah. Well, you know, Andre, the plan was set in motion in early eternity, you know?
Yeah, evidently. Evidently.
Well, any thoughts on that? I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. I wanted to point out, Marvin, that in that last sentence of the paragraph 8, it is the third person enshrouds the second and the first persons, and therefore must always be the first recognized by mm-hmm. all. So you just left out that word first. You just skipped it. But it makes perfect sense that we would first discover the spirit. And, you know, that section that you paused on, Marvin, and read again, that it's through their ministry. And think about mm-hmm. that. What do you think that means? Through their is it the ministry of angels, right? Obviously, they come the closest mm-hmm. to us of the mm-hmm. spiritual orders. And they're ever, this is what I get, they're ever coaching us on.
Yeah,
drawing lovingly,
yes,
patiently. Mm-hmm. You know, they witness, there are silent mm-hmm. witnesses. They witness all that we go through. All the good we do for each other and all the not so good we do to each other, you know? Yet still, they patiently look for ways mm-hmm. to show us the realities of the universe and the goodness of the universe. And so that's what I take from that, is that they're yes. the ones that are actually doing the work that, you know, kind of like the kindergarten teacher. Mm-hmm. She's right in the class with those little ones.
Mm.
You know, mm-hmm. they're there. Their ministry mm-hmm. is what coaxes us on and keeps us. Mm-hmm. I imagine also if we get discouraged all the way up on the mansion world, for instance, and I imagine that there are times when we do get discouraged by the immensity of the task ahead of us,
you know,
the journey ahead of us. That they mm-hmm. are the ones who encourage us and give us encouragement.
Yeah.
You know, it goes back to what we were talking about in the earlier part of the program. I find it fascinating that the ladder by which we climb inward toward the source of all reality and the Trinity is a ladder of living relationships.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, these friendships with our angels. And I've often thought about this. You know, they say that the husband wife relationship, I can't think of a better term, spousal relationship in human families that we experience here does not persist in the afterlife. Well, we're always close to each other, but that arrangement where husbands and wives live together and do life together doesn't persist in the mansion worlds and beyond. But what replaces it is we each receive the companionship, the ongoing, ever-present companionship of an angelic pair. So in a sense, mm-hmm. we're married to our angelic sisters in a certain sense, all the way up to the ascended career. Yeah, and so they provide for this companionship. And it's the living ladder of ascension is a ladder of relationships, which feels so right to me. It's friendships, you know? And you think about how we all have grown and the lives we've led in this life. And I think we'd all agree the most central realities in our lives when all is said and done is the relationships with the people we love and know as spiritual sisters and brothers.
Yeah.
So,
and imagine just how that circle keeps growing.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing to imagine? That circle
Higher
of relationships.
Yeah.
It just mm-hmm. keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I like to say we are not only ascending, we're expanding. We're expanding
mm.
the
skin. Oh, absolutely.
Take
all
of it in. Yeah. And it's hard to expand sometimes, right? You feel like you've been stretched too thin as it is. But I think that's the goal oftentimes, and sometimes the difficulty is what expands you, you know, especially if it's in relationships mm-hmm. and conflicts, you know, you have to stretch yourself to take in another point of view.
Yes.
You have to strengthen yourself to allow.
Yes. all of that is so, that's why whenever I hear that, I always go back to, how big is your God? You know, because, you know, the book, Your God is Too Small by J.B. Phillips. You know, I read that, you know, one of the first books I read when I really got into religion. And it's like he talked about God in a box and how we limit.
Yeah.
And so that's just my version of the new way to say that. How big is your God? In other words,
right.
That's how we grow, is by reaching into the magnanimity that awaits.
Right. Yeah, if we can imagine our God being really, really big, you know, as big as the Arantia book paints him
yes.
to be, then we
stupendous,
can stretch
even.
Our stupendous.
Yes.
I mean, there's really no
and
word good enough, right?
No,
there's no word
no.
big enough to describe how big are the deities
that, comes
that,
up
that
in...
are. Go ahead, Chuck.
They use that word in the fifth paragraph there, describing the kind of exalting surviving world creatures to the divine heights of paradise perfection. I refer to that as a stupendous plan. So God has to be
plan.
At least as big as the plan, right?
Well, right. And even infinitely more.
That
right.
would be pretty stupendous as well.
Yeah. Oh.
Something
well, I was really
in that.
Yeah,
sorry.
I was just really struck by the same thing, Chuck. You know, in paragraph 5, and they say it at the beginning, and they say it at the end of that paragraph. They say the infinite spirit is the effective agent of the all-loving Father and the all-merciful Son for the execution of their conjoint project of drawing to themselves all truth-loving souls on all the worlds of time and space. And then at the end, they say again, he, meaning the infinite spirit, has dedicated all to the stupendous plan of exalting surviving will creatures to the divine heights of paradise perfection. And so for me, it's very impactful that in the earliest, the description of this earliest structure of the cosmos and its purpose, what they're saying is they created everything in order for us to have the experience that we are having of starting at the bottom with nothing and moving all the way up into relationship with them, and that they are companioning us in various ways, sometimes very intimately, like in the presence of the thought adjuster with whom we fuse. They are
right.
part of this experience of starting at the very bottom of almost non-spiritual reality and progressing all the way up through the cosmos to attain the original state of deity relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so to me, it's mind-boggling that we are, in essence, what's happening in our lives is kind of the overall purpose that the Trinity created the universes of time and space for. It's mind-boggling, really. We're the reason they made this whole thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, is to have this experience with them.
We're the pearl of great price for them.
Yeah,
yes.
I think so. And they
yes.
are for us.
Yes.
And they are for
community.
Us. It's...
Yeah, they're the great treasure that we're seeking, you know,
right.
the great pearl. Yeah.
There's that relation again. Yep.
Yeah.
That ever mm-hmm. relation, that, yeah, push me, pull you relationship.
Oh, yeah, and it's so complimental and so perfect and so replete. And, you know, I love that statement you read, Marvin, about the truth is what draws us. So the truth is like mm-hmm. the gravity, you know.
It
I mean,
is,
that's
yeah,
how that
spiritual gravity. Yes,
yeah.
spiritual gravity.
It's the,
yes.
the desire for truth is what's compelling us to move inward. It's why all, you know, what... cults have a masterful mystery, I think is how they put it, because that's whatever, it's that innate curiosity that compels us to keep seeking the truth. And, you know, by the time we get there throughout eternity, you know, in terms of our, however long it takes, I think Chris Halverson has estimated at how many years in our time it would take to get to paradise, but it takes every bit that long to be big enough to take them in, right? To have expanded
about,
enough to take in those great eternal realities in their fullness, to be embraced by them. Wow.
Yeah.
You
about
yeah.
about
yeah.
200
and
billion.
Nothing,
200 billion years.
About 200 billion, okay. I didn't know what the latest estimates were. But when I talk about the immensity, right, the angels encouraging you, we know it's a long time. Just focus on what you need to do today.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
It's really
I've shared this before, and I love to share it because it brings a wonderful departed brother to mind, a long time and very dedicated reader of your Rancher book, Dave Elder, Dave Elders, and his wonderful wife Marta as well. But Dave, you all knew Dave Elders. He was, human beings are individuals, right? Dave Elders was a very individual. He was an unusual thinker. He was a very interesting and very philosophical reader of the Urantia book, who lived in the Northeast. And he described, you were talking about the drawing power, Paula, the gravity that pulls us back up toward paradise.
Yeah.
I love that his metaphor was, he called it the cosmic bungee jump. That the gods created the cosmos and they placed us human beings at the end of this huge cosmic rubber band, right, that stretches all the way from paradise down to these terrestrial mortal spheres, the beginnings of our existence, and we are stretched all the way to the very bottom of spiritual reality, almost where spiritual reality doesn't exist. And then by this drawing power of the rubber band starts to move its way back up to its original source. And we move all the way through the cosmos until we eventually get all the way back up to the originator of the whole deal. But I love it. The idea of the big cosmic bungee jump. It was very visual. Only would come up with that.
And the, kind of like the thought adjuster is the cord. Yeah, that's what I was just going to say, Chuck.
Yeah,
there you
He's the bungee.
The
thought adjuster
is the
bungee. Yeah, right. He pulls you back in, back up. That's what's attached. That's the attachment right there. Yeah, we're getting some feedback, Marvin, just so you know. I think it might be your hearing aid.
This idea.
I'll mute. So.
Thanks, Marvin. Thanks. Or adjust it or whatever. It often helps. Go ahead, Chuck. Sorry to interrupt you.
I was just struck by the language there in that sentence. The drawing to themselves.
Yes.
Like the way they put that. There's this universal and around the idea of drawing us, or they want our association, they draw us to themselves, at least all truth-loving souls. But that just sounds very parental.
It does.
Very affectionate and loving kind of way.
Like a big hug.
It's great, this whole creation, now they want to share it with their kids,
Like the ocean, too, ever moving,
Yes.
Vast and
come
deep.
Come home.
And, drawing you home. The second paragraph really intrigued me. Were you going to say that, Jack? Since the personalization of the third source, the first source no more personally participates in universe creation. So the first source withdraws. The universal father delegates everything possible to the eternal son. Likewise, does the eternal son bestow all possible authority and power upon the conjoint creator. So they're really relying on, no wonder they refer to the third person as the conjoint actor or the conjoint creator. But that really intrigued me, no longer participates. Mm-hmm. And then they take over. And what I found very touching is where they say, and it was this, I'm trying to remember where it was, but this universe son, here it is, a creator son and eternal of the eternal son and a creative spirit of the infinite spirit created you. And your universe.
Yes.
Yes. And while the Father in Faithfulness upholds that which they have organized, it devolves upon this Universe Son and this Universe Spirit to foster and sustain their work. And then they bring it home by personally saying, and it was just such a situation which you appeared, right? Your mm-hmm. eternal Son, your Creator Son and your Creative Spirit created you.
Yeah.
I don't know. It just mm-hmm. plumbs a depth that's almost unfathomable for me, you know? It just thrills me to think of it. And,
you know, there's
and
a
lately,
parallel.
Well, yeah, and it, yeah.
There's a parallel there that's very interesting. You know, if you think about our nature, what a human being, how a human being is constituted, what they're telling us is that the personality comes directly from the Universal Father. So not the Son or the Spirit actually give us our personality. That actually is a gift of the Father. But our our bodily vehicle, our mind structure, the environment we live in, the home we live in, everything other than the personality is the creation of our local Creator Son and Mother Spirit.
Wow.
With all of their mm-hmm. Children, you know, the life carriers planning everything, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an interesting parallel there. Sorry. Now teach me to eat nuts while talking. The parallel is that's very similar, well, not very similar, but there's a parallel to our human creation of our children. We mm-hmm. contribute the plasm, and we raise them, and we create homes. But we don't give them their essential nature. We don't give them their personality. That is always the gift of the Father. But we are partners in the raising of God's children,
mm-hmm.
just like the Creator Son and Mother Spirit are. So there's sort of a threefold parallel as it moves on down in its expression.
Right. We're the last rung in that cosmic ladder. Yeah.
Which is really lovely. You know, in a certain
sense.
Or the
first one. Look at it.
Yeah, yeah. In a mm-hmm. certain sense, we act out the functions of the Trinity as Father and Mother and co-creators and sisters and brothers. I mean, all of that, we're replicating mm-hmm. the relationships in the Trinity mm-hmm. at our level, as are the Creator Son and the Mother Spirit.
Yes. Yes, there's so many aspects of Trinity in our life, and that's why I really love this topic, because Trinity is all around us, all those relationships, and they're all so fundamental, and we take them for granted. We take them for granted. I mean, even logos are very often Trinity. I mean, the Mercedes emblem, for one. You know, that's just one example.
Many.
So it's everywhere and foundational and relational. And that is, I think, the word, Marvin, yes. Relational is the essence of it all.
Agreed.
And you know, and it's like there's just, I don't know.
Well, I'm just agreeing with you 100% here, Pam. The way I like to think about it is that the entire cosmos, the drama that's unfolding in the cosmos is a drama of persons and relationships. And all of the rest is backdrop, in a sense. That's front and center, what's happening. And from the beginning. Yeah.
You know, this conversation reminds me of a great passage from Jesus's life where he spends, and I know I've read this one on the air before, but it's just always so relevant in so many conversations. And it's from paper 177, where Jesus spends a day alone in the hills with John Mark. And it's that in itself is such a splendid story, because the boy is persistent and he wants to go with Jesus well, Jesus wants to go out alone for a while and pray, and, you know, he's coming to the end of his life, and John Mark insists that he goes with the master and takes the basket, the lunch basket, and Jesus grants him permission to go, and the universe knows that story as the day a boy spent alone in the hills with God. And the master, as is always his way, talked to John about things that were relevant in his near future, knowing that this young man would probably get married and have a family in the near future. I'm thinking John was maybe 15, 16. And so this is the paragraph. It's paper 17725. It says, for more than an hour, Jesus and John continued this discussion of home life. The master went on to explain to John how a child is wholly dependent on his parents and the associated home life for all his early concepts of everything, intellectual, social, moral, and even spiritual, since the family represents to the young child all that he can first know of either human or divine relationships. The child must derive his first impressions of the universe from the mother's care. He is wholly dependent on the earthly father for his first ideas of the heavenly father. The child's life, the child's subsequent life, is made happy or unhappy, easy or difficult, in accordance with his early mental and emotional life, conditioned by these social and spiritual relationships of the home. A human being's entire afterlife is enormously influenced by what happens during the first few years of existence. You know, they're talking about their that foundation again. Our Jesus is talking mm-hmm. about it to John Mark. You know, this is how important it is. You are the first rung on this ladder going up toward paradise and the last one coming down. You know, the buck stops with you, young man.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
there's this. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead and finish, Paul, and then I'll share my thoughts.
Well, that's just so essential. When they tell us that marriage is our greatest purely human achievement, it's like, I think they're saying we figured that one out on our own. And it is so foundational to all that is. To learn those lessons that happen in those primary relationships, mother, father, child.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and just to add on to that, and take to sort of connect it back up to what you were saying at the beginning, Paula, which is that without the Trinity and the relations between persons, love only happens in that environment. Right. And there's this other seminal passage, which we've read many times, but it's so relevant in paper 117. All true love, this is 117:6-10, all true love is from God. And man receives the divine affection as he himself bestows this love upon his fellows. Love is dynamic. It can never be captured. It is alive, free, thrilling, and always moving. Man can never take the love of the Father and imprison it within his heart. The Father's love can become real to mortal man only by passing through that man's personality as he in turn bestows this love upon his fellows. The great circuit of love is from the Father through sons and daughters to brothers and sisters, and hence to the Supreme. The love of the Father appears in the mortal personality by the ministry of the indwelling adjuster. Such a God-knowing Son reveals this love to his universe brethren, and this fraternal affection is the essence of the love of the Supreme. And so it adds a dimension there that the summation of these loving relationships is expressed in the deity of the Supreme, which is somehow that's really lovely. And the Supreme has quite a profound relationship to the Trinity. sort of in a resulting fashion.
That's an end goal, right?
Yeah.
That's a Trinity end goal, I think, the actualization of the Supreme.
Well, they say that when you find the Father, you will have found the great cause of your universe ascent.
Right.
And when you find the Mother Supreme, you will find the great result of our universe ascent, which is quite profound, really. Yeah, she is the summation. She's the summation of the relationships of the Trinity, in a certain sense, our Mother, the Supreme.
Mm-hmm. The summation of ultimate achievement.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Paradise Mother
now
Spirit.
We're romancing the universe now, you guys.
Nice.
Yeah. Something about that just feels so right and so good. Something about contemplating their love for us. You know.
Yes.
Go ahead, Pam.
I was going to say, and patience. I've been thinking about the word patience is not even mentioned, and yet that's got to be the bottom. I mean, I suppose that's involved with love, but the specific aspect of patience, dealing with us way out here at the end of the bungee cord, it's like what it must take.
Well, let me ask you this. You guys, can you think of anything that requires more patience than being a parent?
I don't think so.
I think,
You know, there's a parallel there, Paula, and I think of it often. It's a very similar form of patience that's required when we are each dealing with each other and our own immaturities. It's very similar to what I experience as a parent. Living with the immaturity of our children, you're right. It's profound patience, and it feels like a very similar form of patience in the sister brother relationship when we are each dealing with each other's immaturities. You know, it's the same parental love that we need to bring to bear, I think.
Yes, and that's why Jesus admonished us, right? To love each other, not only as we perceive, you know, we want to be loved, but as we perceive God would do. As we perceive God would love.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And because God, it loves with a parental love. So what he's telling us to is that to, you know, start channeling that parental love into our human brothers and sisters, you know, that's one of my favorite quotes that you read, Marvin. And interestingly, paper 117, God the Supreme. That's an extraordinary paper. And, you know, within it is that beautiful gem about love. You cannot capture it. It's alive, free, thrilling, and always moving. I love that. You can't imprison it in your heart.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
You have to let it move through you. You have to. That's the only way it will do the good it's meant to do, is if you let it move through you into humanity. And it brings back Jesus' admonition over and over and over to just love yourself. Love as I have loved. Love. Devote your lives to proving that love is the greatest thing in the universe. It's like a theme in this book. It's the main theme. If anything, that is the golden thread that all the rest of it is hung on, the love of our creators for us and the consequent love that we must have for each other. We must learn to express and feel.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Well, it's interesting.
I think there might be a direct relationship between patience and love. Actually, if you think about it.
True.
And I think the patience is perhaps proportional to our perception of potential. When you think about Jesus and the apostles, he was so patient with them. He could see their potential, not just in his life, but in eternity. And then they speak about how a person could be transformed just by Jesus smiling upon them, right? And I've always liked to think that Jesus could see the finality or potential in every person. He can see their destiny. And that was the sort of the, one of the main factors that inspired such profound love and patience, you know, seeing the potential. And when I think of ourselves, you know, he was talking about our creators being patient with us. I think it's because they know where we're headed, but we can't get there in one day. You know, we have to work through everything it takes to get there. You know, this stupendous plan of drawing us into the presence of deity. Love, patience, connection is the main thing.
Here's the rub. They see the stumbling blocks too, Chuck, as we do as parents too, but they see in crystal clear perception. I mean, they see into the future and see what we're going to stumble on.
Well, Jesus, you know, that phrase that he would say so often, and I can see him saying it, is, you know, Simon, Simon, how long shall I bear with you?
Or James, or whoever it happened
James,
to be.
James, right? Exactly. And it's just like, and the answer is, I'll bear with you forever, as long as,
for
it,
as
takes,
long as it
you
takes,
know?
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
70 times 7, isn't that what he used to say?
Yeah, and that's tough stuff, you know, because we humans tend to, and I think, you know, on this world especially, we have to make boundaries, you know, but oftentimes when I think of relationships that aren't, you know, that are maybe dragging me down or harming, doing more harm in my life than good, I think of that situation as a temporal situation. And I think of that relationship, even if I have to distance myself from a relationship that's gotten toxic in the moment, I try to remember that it won't always be toxic and that people do change. We all do. We grow up to different levels. You know, I like to say I want to be just like Jesus when I grow up, you know, which...
Someday,
you know,
when I grow up.
I am a baby spirit, right? I'll admit it. I'm just working these things out.
one of the things, in keeping with what you're saying, Paula, one of the things that has been helpful for me when I'm interacting with someone who's a little hard to interact with, and, you know, we're all that way with each other, right? Sometimes I'm going to be hard to interact with on the part of another person.
Right.
But So you know, we're always in both positions. But something that's been helpful for me when I'm I'm around someone who's challenging to be with, is to remember, you know, there's a very good chance that I'm going to know this person forever.
Yeah.
That we are going to have an eternal relationship, and that this person who maybe has this immaturity or that immaturity, and I have my own immaturities, my own rough edges, you know, we're going to be bumping each other and relating to each other and loving each other and maturing and growing forever together.
Right.
So you know, the caution for me is, be careful. Don't wound, you know, your brother or your sister out of impatience. We're going to be together a long time. So just, you know, slow down, take a deep breath, and try and have that perspective. That's been very helpful for me at times, because it's easy for me to get impatient sometimes.
Easy for all of us, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's a thing that we all need to watch out for, you know. I think that as we do mature, at least the thought controller kicks in. And adjust that thought, you know, right away. That's what I've noticed. It's like, no, this isn't going to serve. This isn't going to help anything. If you say that, that isn't going to help anything.
Right.
That's not going to make the situation better. Right?
As much as you may want to.
Yeah. As much as you may want to vent on that person, it isn't going to help.
No.
As our old friend Steve Dreyer used to say, that may put off a lot of light, but that light gives heat and not light. You know?
Yeah.
Hot. You know, that's not enlightened honesty. That's just heat. And heat sometimes just wants to burn everything down and isn't, you know, focused on salvation or upholding something or creating something better, something more meaningful. It's just destructive. So, yeah, I mean, patience, yeah, is, gosh, aren't we glad they're patient with us?
Mm-hmm.
And lately, you know, when I think of Jesus as a father, brother, and I love that, my dear friend Joanne always used to start her prayers, "Dear Father, Brother Jesus."
Mm-hmm.
I've been thinking of him more lately as a brother and not a father. You know, I think of him as a father a lot. I have. And I think it's ironic that in his material life, he played the role of father, brother, right? Isn't that interesting? It was a universe in parallel.
Yeah, it really was. And I also really like to think of Jesus as my eldest brother.
Yes,
you know, the oldest brother in the family. And that's really true, because actually the Creator Son is an order of the sons, right? And we are sons of God as well. We're in that order. We are created beings of the Creator Parent. And so we share that nature with Jesus, with the Master. We're both persons of the Creator being, the Father. And Jesus was trying to say to us, you know, the kind of relationship I have with my Father is the kind that you can have with our common Father. So he really is our eldest brother in many ways, yeah.
In so many sublime ways.
Yeah, I want to say one other thing related to your thought controller comment, Paula, which is fascinating. I don't know if this will come across. For me, it's been an experience of slowly over decades developing an inclination to be listening inwardly while I'm listening outwardly, to be bivalent in the hearing mode, to be with people. And I think Jesus did this really well and perfectly. He was always listening to the prompts of the indwelling spirit while he interacted with human beings. So he was facing inwardly at the same time that he was always facing and serving outwardly. And I think that's part of the thought controller development, is that inner listening that I think becomes 24/7. I think for Jesus, it was 24/7, unbroken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
But they talk about communion, unbroken communion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Which I don't, yes. I don't understand. I don't think that means that it was passive.
Not at all.
And I think we have to be a little careful with the word listen. You know, there's a sensitivity and a responsiveness in that I think is what's part of the communion experience, but it's not passive in some sense. I don't know. There's a tricky place in the middle of all that where we participate actively in our communion, in our inner communion, which does involve listening, but it also involves engaging in some dynamic way.
Agreed.
I don't know.
No, I agree. Yeah. It's a dialogue.
Yeah.
Well, it's very interesting to consider all of that.
Can I just throw in one more thing?
Yeah, go ahead.
On that.
Yeah.
And then on to you go.
Okay, cool. Yeah, this is quick. But I just wanted to report that I noticed in the Arantia book, in all of the religion papers and the thought adjuster papers, the word listen never appears.
Mm.
And I was kind of struck by that. That's interesting. A note.
In all the thought adjuster papers?
Thought adjuster papers and the religion papers. The word listen never appears. You can check me
that's
on that.
Interesting. No.
How about here? How about here?
I don't know. I didn't check every possibility. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah,
hearing.
Yeah, like hearing.
But I just thought that was
voice.
Mm-hmm. There's one place where Jesus. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, go ahead.
Well, one of the things that is there, I don't know if in that, so I'm just checking on those those papers, and I think that's instructive. That's a fascinating find, that listen is not there, because that's how most of us, that's how it's been presented to us. We need to listen and hear what the Father Jester is saying, but that's not really, you know, what we're being told. But one of the things that is said is religious growth leads from stagnation through conflict to coordination. It's the spirit leading, something that it's your thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you Godward, and so on. And so in the religion papers, they're using that word lead. And if I look, I'll bet I'll find that these are also used equally in the Thought Adjuster papers, that there are leadings. So that's a very interesting distinction, isn't it? That they're trying, and the reason I'm bringing that out is, though, you know, I respect what Chuck is saying in terms of the intention that we need to have and the attention we need to have. Remember, they tell us that you should not think of this as such a conscious process, and that they refer to the conscious level as the dead level of consciousness, that most of these things are happening in the superconscious realms, the realms above our consciousness, the realms of the interface with the Thought Adjuster. And the reason I bring that out is those of us that grew up in some particular religious traditions were well schooled in how easy it was to get it wrong, and how you know it really doesn't matter how hard you try, you're really not going to ever be as good as the saints, the ones that came before you and that did it really well, and the apostles, after all, were so great, such paragons of sainthood, that we depict them with halos and paintings and whatnot. And we, of course, in the Arantia book, were disabused of that notion. We find out just how human these apostles were, and that it was entirely a growth process, along with grace, along with the grace of the Spirit of Truth, that then led them to this place of being able to be in greater and greater resonance and alignment with the will of God. And so I think about that, and I think about my own walk toward God, and realize just how imperfect it is. And you look at it and you say, so how badly am I doing this? Glass half empty. Or, Father, you know, is it possible here that though I really lack a great deal of consciousness of you and never practically hear your voice, I hear leadings or hear the odd thing once in a while, and I have only generally heard, quote unquote, anything strongly when I seem to be about to go the wrong way. You know, more in my past than the present, thank goodness. But still, you know, those are the kinds of things where I get those kinds of significant leadings. And I think about that, and I realize that a lot of it is sitting in silence and trusting that we're being led and doing the next right thing as well as we can measure within ourselves to do so.
Right.
This is a fascinating thread of conversation. I want to thank you, Chuck, for, you know, focusing on the listening. And it's sort of connected to the thought controller issue. Well, I want to share two quotes, that one of which is pretty instructive and the other one of which is one of the most amazing passages in the book, and one that doesn't get looked at very often for its implications. So the first one is in the Jesus Papers, that's 146-217, and it does have the word listening in it. They say Jesus taught his followers that when they had made their prayers to the Father, they should remain for a time in silent receptivity to afford mm-hmm. the indwelling spirit the better opportunity to speak to the listening soul. Mm-hmm. The spirit
yeah,
of
I was going to mention that.
The spirit of the Father, the spirit of the Father speaks best to man when the human mind is in an attitude of true worship. We worship God by the aid of the Father's indwelling spirit and by the illumination of the human mind through the ministry of truth, which would be Jesus' spirit of truth. Worship, taught Jesus, makes one increasingly like the being who is worshipped. Worship is a transforming experience whereby the finite gradually approaches and ultimately attains the presence of the infinite. And then in relation to that passage, this is one of the most intriguing paragraphs in the book to me, is 10951. It's in the Adjuster Papers, and they say, supreme and self-acting adjusters are often able to contribute factors of spiritual import to the human mind when it flows freely in the liberated but controlled channels of creative imagination, which I want to say definitely has some connection to the worship state. But that phrase, when it flows freely in the liberated but controlled channels of creative imagination, at such times and sometimes during sleep, the adjuster is able to arrest the mental currents, stay the flow, and then to divert the idea procession.
Restrict.
And all this is done in order to effect deep spiritual transformations in the higher recesses of the superconsciousness. Thus are the forces and energies of mind more fully adjusted to the key of the contactual tones of the spiritual level of the present and the future. That paragraph,
wow.
I mean, that is such an astounding series of ideas, really. That I think we haven't even scratched the surface on the implications of that paragraph and its relationship to worship and what's going on in this, what we call a listening or silent receptivity process, both in our conscious minds, but primarily in above the level of conscious awareness in the superconsciousness, how the adjuster's working in us. It's just an amazing piece of language, actually.
Mm-hmm.
What was that reference again?
Yeah, very much so.
Okay, so 10951.
Yeah, that's posted in the chat now.
Okay.
Yeah.
One of the things that Jesus stressed that I always come back to is in his second discourse on religion, you know, where he says to the apostles that your theories about God aren't so important. It's your growth and the ability to feel the presence of God. That emphasis, I think, again, suggests a dynamic engagement, you know, feeling the presence of God. And he didn't say listening for words in your head or listening, you know, for voices in your head that are not your own. He's saying work on feeling the presence of God. That creates engagement. And I think when we feel the presence of God, that improves our quality of our thought. You know, if you're with somebody that's inspiring and just being with them makes you want to be at your best kind of thing.
Yes.
And that experience improves the quality of our thoughts, you know, because we have that spirit input, you know, the value level input from spirit, which can lead, like you're saying, lead our thinking in more, you know, effective directions and, you know, just the whole experience of thought and what that's all about. So, you know, I always, through all this, I always get the feeling that, you know, or the idea that the adjuster is pre-personal. It's not, we shouldn't think of the thought adjuster as a little person in our head. It functions in this other way. When we feel the presence of the adjuster, it improves our own quality of thought. And that relates to those stages of adjuster, you know, the controller, adjuster, changer, that whole progression of our engagement with our adjuster, a lot of that seems to be driven by the idea of feeling the presence, not necessarily hearing words, but feeling the presence. And there's, you know, it's a tricky thing, but presence is a very mysterious phenomenon, actually.
Yeah, we were talking about that last week, and I thought it was a really good conversation
yeah,
to have.
Yeah.
Because
right.
I think
well,
when,
you know, what makes
you know,
it
go ahead,
especially interesting. I don't know. Maybe we talked about this last week. I don't remember exactly. But in paper 42, 12.9, they say that the presence phenomenon of a personality, I'm kind of summarizing the sentence, the presence phenomenon of a personality is not a manifestation of energy, either physical, mindful, or spiritual. So the experience of presence and sensitivity to presence, the phenomenon of presence, is in some other category, and it apparently transcends time and space, or space at least. You know, we can feel the presence of deity regardless of where we are. It's not limited by geographic distance or anything like that.
Right.
It's like a, I don't know, I just think that's, it's fascinating, and it actually ties into what we just—it ties into what we just read. If I could just make one more comment, in paragraph 5 of the section, you know, in the paper we're reading, they say toward the end of the sentence, they're explaining how the, you know, infinite spirit becomes the agent of the Father's Son in their plan, and they say, in so doing, the infinite spirit pledged all his resources of divine presence and of spirit personalities to the Father and the Son. So I'm intrigued by how they use the word presence in there. You know, it's not exactly clear to me what they mean. When they say the infinite spirit pledged all his resources of divine presence and of spirit personalities. So spirit personalities, I can imagine being the angels and all the ministering spirits and all of that. But what do they mean when they say the infinite spirit pledged all his resources of divine presence? Are they talking about the divine presence of the infinite spirit, or are they talking about something else there?
I think they're talking
I
about
would read
his omnipresence, but
okay.
You know,
because I don't think you can separate presence from personality.
You know, there's a metaphor. There's a metaphor that has always been helpful for me. And this is all connected, and what you're sharing and what you're bringing up, Chuck, I think is very connected. The whole listening, the whole thing of how is it that we perceive or sense or feel whatever God is trying to give us, right? And this language in that paragraph that I shared about the human mind flowing freely in the liberated but controlled channels of the creative imagination. And the connection to worship states, where I think in the worship state, you use the word feeling the presence of God. That's been part of my experience in worship, is that there's a felt sense of God's presence inwardly and a kind of a reception process going on. God is giving us something somehow. And there's a metaphor that's been helpful for me. I think our consciousness inevitably and inseparably resides in mind, in our minds, right? Where we are aware of things. That's where we experience things. And increasingly in the mind/soul vehicle, as our soul evolves, we begin to have felt experiences in that mind-soul space of consciousness, and we begin to sense or feel the presence of God and other spiritual realities. And the metaphor that's been helpful for me is to think of my mind as an instrument, like a piano, and that normally I'm sitting on the bench at the piano, little me, and playing melodies, right? I'm thinking things, I'm creating stuff on that instrument, and I'm listening to what I'm creating. And the sense of receptivity and the creative processing that I think comes in worship is akin to me getting up off the bench and saying to God, "You play for a while, and I'm going to listen to your melodies." And in a sense, it's all happening in the medium of our minds, because that's the only way we have to be conscious of anything. And they say it's happening in the upper realms, the superconscious realms of mind, and it trickles down to something that we can hear and understand, but it's all happening within the medium of our thinking, of our mind, which is a ministry of the spirit, right? Our mind is a medium provided to us. It's a circuitry. It's an environment that the infinite spirit has provided for us. And so the infinite spirit's presence is the very medium with which we think, but the act of, quote, listening, unquote, is, for me, it's the act of sitting back and saying, you play on the instrument of my mind. Show me your truth, your reality. I'm going to listen for a little bit. So that's helpful for me, that metaphor. I don't know if it helps for any of you guys.
Well, it does. I love that metaphor. And, you know, this conversation has left me thinking about what it feels like to be a tiny baby, right? A baby. And how you don't understand what anyone is saying to you. But what you do understand is they're present and they love you. And you can feel
it. And you
their
feel
love.
It. Exactly.
You feel it. And yeah. So whether you understand what I love you means or not, you feel it first before you ever understand it. And it's like that. We're all learning to feel God's love. We may not fully understand it, but we're learning to feel it. And someday when we're born out of this world where we see through a glass darkly, right? We discussed that last week, where we're so embryonic in this life. But when we get our new body and our new senses, we will perceive so much more of these universe realities, especially
yeah.
presence. Especially love. I mean, so many people who have near-death experiences come back saying, wow, the experience of love was overwhelming. I was overwhelmed by the experience of love that I felt. I think it'll be like that because we'll be taking it in. When we feel a presence, we're taking it in on some level. And feeling is a sensation, right? But oftentimes our sense of hearing, our sense of sight interfere with that. And I was going to say, Helen Keller, for instance, learned how to feel love before she, you know, probably, I mean, obviously had an amazing life. But Annie Sullivan, the miracle worker, broke through to her and helped her understand what she was feeling by giving her a language that put that into context. And that's happening to all of us on some level. And so this idea to learn to feel the presence, I think is, it, you know, Chuck, you said, Jesus said it, it's true. We do well to know about the fact of God, but we would do better to learn to feel his presence. And once we do that, maybe we can begin to recognize it then, you know. And when we recognize it, now we know what we're, you know, experiencing. And we know who is with us then.
And you know, you add to that, I agree with you 100%, Paula. It's like we have very, one way to understand it is we have very lousy equipment down here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our equipment for hearing the voice or the leading of God is very ill-developed. It's embryonic.
Mm-hmm.
So
we don't understand that language yet, just like a baby.
No,
we don't know.
And what we're hearing is extremely muffled. It's garbled. It's all messed up because our medium for listening is very imperfect. We're animals, right? We don't have Marantia minds. We have physiologically based biochemical minds, which is an incredibly poor instrument for sensing Marantia, much less spiritual reality. And they say something really fascinating. They say that upon awakening on the mansion worlds, we will hear the voice of the adjuster directly.
I know.
That's what a stunning thing to think about, that we won't have this muffled apparatus. We'll have clear minds that can hear that voice directly without any distortion.
I thought about, you think it'll speak through our voice?
I don't think it's going to be a voice in the way we understand the voice directly, but I think
we will. Mm-hmm. We will have a voice.
Mm-hmm. Well, but Chuck, you know, there is one place in the Urantia book where they actually give us the words of an adjuster to their subject.
Oh, I know.
You know that one paragraph.
Possible. I'm not saying it's not possible.
I think we'll hear it.
It's what I'm intrigued by.
Yeah.
I think we will hear it that directly. I think we'll hear it.
The equivalent of words. And what's the mechanism for that?
Well, I think the Maranatha mind is attentive and attuned to the communication of the adjuster in a way that the mortal mind is utterly unable or very poorly able to receive.
Well, here's the thought, you guys.
If the adjuster
gives us identity and we give the adjuster personality, which is a classic betrothal, a true union, then wouldn't the adjuster, as it filters through our personality, since it's pre-personal, sound a lot like us?
That's what I'm thinking. I mean, we become one. Upon fusion, the adjuster is you.
You've now made it complete that you have given him your personality. Now he is you and you are him.
Yeah.
And the transition is complete then. So as he filters through your personality, I think he will sound a lot like you. And so the key is not what it sounds like. The key is the quality of the communication that you're hearing, that you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you hear it or not, whether we even have ears on the magic world, I don't know. We have a sense of sound, though, somehow. We can imagine we have all seven senses that we have here and then 10 times more, right? So, wow, that blows your mind.
But the idea of an inner voice is, intriguing.
Yeah, the still small voice,
But whose voice is it,
That's it. That's what you have to decide. What is that guidance?
As we grow closer to fusion with our adjuster, I don't know if they're distinguishable. At least they say it's not the outside observer. It's not distinguishable.
It wouldn't need to be distinguishable at that level, though, once you fuse. But prior to that, you probably do need to distinguish it because it gets more and more prevalent.
So when you have an inner dialogue, let's say, you're trying to bring adjuster into that inner dialogue somehow. When you're having an inner dialogue, it's always in your own voice, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're thinking about a friend and what he might say. But when I think about Andre or something Andre said, I hear Andre's voice. I do.
Uh-huh.
Or yours, Chuck, or anybody's. I mean, if I know a personality and they said something to me that I always remember, when I recount that thought, I hear it in their voice.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Mm-hmm. So, one thing we ought to remember in that regard is that mind is the mind matrix that the adjuster himself has preserved for us, has made, both in the soul and carries as the memories that they somehow carry in their mind matrix, in the matrix of, the thought adjuster that they carry. So everything about our minds has been sponsored by the thought adjuster.
Mm.
So that would be one of the reasons that that we can tune in much better. But why would it not be then in our voice? Why would it not be patterned in our voice that way, or alternatively, in some voice that we would, psychologically or super psychologically project as quote unquote a father's voice to us, whatever it is that's important at that stage for us to acknowledge and perhaps perceive as different than our own as well. It's a fascinating question.
Yeah.
It'll be answered for us in a few short decades, but we can hardly imagine it now.
Mm-hmm. And that also applies to the experience of feeling the presence. So when we feel the presence of God, we're feeling the presence of another being, essentially. Mm-hmm. It's not us, but it's seeking relationship and even fusion with us through the adjuster.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that.
Can you describe
it's
that?
It's a very sort of paradoxical situation, I think, we find ourselves in relation to God, where we want to become like God, and we want God to infuse our nature. And that does eventually happen. But there's this sort of process of thinking things through, you know, our thoughts leading us Godward, whatever that, however we interpret that. So there's a lot of dialogue going on, inner dialogue, puzzling things out. And if that's treated as a conversation with this inner presence of God, then that uplifts it, you know, to this whole other level, because we can feel that presence and we want to engage with it. You know, it's like if you're with some person, you know, like some, let's say some older person who's like mastered life and they're like, you know, you want to learn from them. So you want to talk to them and you want to hear what they have to say and you want to be influenced by them because you know that they have a lot to offer as an influence. And if you find yourself in a conversation with that person, your conversation is going to be elevated. You know, I want to try and elevate it to their level, right? So you can understand what they're saying. But to really grasp it, you know, it's almost like you have to repeat it back to yourself or something like that. You know, to get that mind integration of a spiritual insight, there's inner dialogue involved, I think, at least in my experience.
Oh, absolutely. And if you know, what they say to you hits home, you'll think about it for a long time.
Yeah, if it's actually another person. And we've all had maybe some mentors in our lives when we were younger or whatever, where we could just treasure the words of someone that we happened to cross paths with.
Absolutely.
That's more like a Jesus relationship.
Jesus actually is
another person. If he was in the room, we could talk to him just like we would anyone else. Kind of functions in a different way. So I was curious, Marvin, what you were, a minute ago when you were, we were talking about this, that in the next world, you know, where they say that we'll be able to hear the adjuster's voice. How you interpret that?
Well, let me just share a few. There are four short passages that have allusion to this, if I can share them. One is 110:3:1. Adjusters are playing the sacred and superb game of the ages. They are engaged in one of the supreme adventures of space, and how happy they are when your cooperation permits them to lend assistance. But usually when your adjuster attempts to communicate with you, the message is lost in the material currents of the energy streams of the human mind. Only occasionally do you catch an echo, a faint and distant echo of the divine voice. So the next one is 110:5:1. Do not confuse and confound the mission and influence of the adjuster with what is commonly called conscience. They are not directly related. Conscience is a human and purely psychic reaction. It is not to be despised, but it is hardly the voice of God to the soul, which indeed the adjusters would be if such a voice could be heard. And then the next one, 110:5:6, in varying degrees and increasingly as you ascend the psychic circles, sometimes directly, but more often indirectly, you do communicate with your adjusters, but it is dangerous to entertain the idea that every new concept originating in the human mind is the dictation of the adjuster. More often, in beings of your order, that which you accept as the adjuster's voice is in reality the emanation of your own intellect. The last one is 110:7:9. While the voice of the adjuster is ever within you, which is interesting wording, while the voice of the adjuster is ever within you, most of you will hear it seldom during a lifetime. Human beings below the third and second circles of attainment rarely hear second and third. Yeah. So in other words, the third, second, and first circles is where you might begin to hear this more. Human beings below the third and second circles of attainment rarely hear the adjuster's direct voice, except in moments of supreme desire in a supreme situation and consequent upon a supreme desire.
Those are all compelling thoughts.
Go ahead. One more to
put in that category, also from paper 110.5.6, is where they say, more often in beings of your order, that which you accept as the adjuster's voice is in reality the emanation of your own intellect. And then they say, this is dangerous ground. And every human being must settle these problems for himself in accordance with his natural human wisdom and superhuman insight. So there's, you know, I think it's interesting that they comment about this being dangerous ground. You know, if we can misinterpret the emanation of our own intellect as the adjuster's voice, you know, and elevate that to some unrealistic.
Why it's dangerous would be a whole conversation, but
I know,
you were going to say something.
That's kind of the flip side of this whole thing.
This is a great dive into the thought adjuster. And I would really like for someone to bring this conversation back to the infinite spirit.
Yes, I was making that too.
Topic.
Well, that's why I was intrigued by that present statement about the infinite spirit.
That's part of
what infinite spirit does, you know, is apply this universal presence.
The infinite spirit is the presence of the absolute mind. You know, that's one of the aspects of the presence. You know, it's less the presence of the absolute personality of the infinite spirit. What we do know is the infinite spirit is the infinite and absolute mind, the container for all mind that is in the universe. And we know that, you know, the spirit's agents, the angels and super angels and such, are all of the infinite spirit's nature in bringing us up through and growing our minds and growing them toward God. So to me, that's a big part of that presence that is being talked about. But they're making it easy to bridge by also mentioning the spirit personalities.
Right. Yeah, we can kind of know the spirits through the angels, I think. I mean, the character, the nature.
Right.
So in that regard, just as an aside to that, but on this topic of, you know, more related to the infinite spirit, have you ever given concept, you know, we think about our angels a lot and it can only do us good to think about our angels and all of that. And I agree with that. And you have people naming their angels and you have people, I remember John Hales, God bless him. You know, he would say, well, I've called my angel Charlotte and somebody else, or maybe that was his thought adjuster. I don't remember anymore. But the point is, you know, I reflected on that and I think about the fact that for a millennium of universe time, and each millennium is 5,000 years of our time, they simply function as observers. Okay? That's their first millennium of life. Their second millennium of life, they go through the initial Seraphington schools, giving them their initial training. Then they're assigned to the constellations for some indefinite period. Then they're assigned to a system, and long before they're ever achieve, you know, the status, which they say is a high service status of being assigned as a guardian seraphim, that they have undergone all kinds of training and all kinds of service before they're assigned. Have you ever considered, even if we have just group guardians at this point, how old and experienced your angels are?
Mm.
Have you ever considered how many tens of thousands of years old, maybe even hundreds of thousands of years old, your angels are?
Mm.
And have you ever considered how presumptuous very often we are about what our angels could be thinking or doing, and how limited
finding
our own thoughts are about them?
Yeah.
So I just wanted to throw that into the mix.
That's good to remember that. Yeah,
it is.
Yeah. Beings. Yeah,
but you know, think about it.
They're like,
they're not inexperienced.
No.
Right. Yeah.
If you were an angel, though.
Well, it also
and if,
trust involved in being a guardian.
Yeah.
You know, they don't just pass that out like candy. You got to be prepared.
No.
You got to be able to handle that responsibility.
Especially on this planet.
Yeah.
Really. Imagine, though, if you were an angel and your little charge. Imagine everything that Andre just said, that you would experience that. You've been around for hundreds of thousands of years, maybe millions of years.
Mm-hmm.
And you've reached a level where your trustworthiness entitles you to be a guard of a tiny little human being. Imagine how you would feel, the joy you would feel when that human had enough faith in you to ask you to help, even in a little way, like finding a parking spot.
Oh, yes. The parking angel.
You know,
yes, I forgot about
those. You believe in me enough
I can't forget about
that you think I could help you with this. That's a joyful thing. That's like a little child putting their hand in yours and trusting you enough to cross the street with you. And they get to the point where they
it's
just
kind of
endearing.
Really.
It is endearing. So I don't discount that when I say to my angels, help me out here, because I love you and I know you're there and I know you want to help, and maybe you don't want to help with this, but I'm still going to ask you because I just have so much faith in you to guide me well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it gives them joy. I don't think they're about, oh gosh, you're asking me to do some stupid mundane thing. You know, they're more about, you're asking me to help. Oh,
I think
awesome.
It's the faith dimension that's honored in all these kind of things.
Exactly.
Anything that's a demonstration of faith is going to be recognized. Or there's some value there. You know, that's what Jesus said.
Oh, there's tremendous value there.
Things. It was your faith that healed you.
I like to think of the midwares and what joy it gave them to know that finally we'd know they exist.
Oh, yeah.
We know who they are and what they do.
Yeah.
Even rudimentarily, you know, we still don't have much of a concept, but we have much better concept. But in that regard, conversely.
With your answer book. Sorry, what?
You know, trying to think from the angel's perspective, you know, looking down at us and say, you know, at them asking the question of us, do you realize how far down the road I am looking at your life and what I am doing with you today that takes into account your next several hundred, perhaps few thousand years?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Destiny.
Yes.
And some of that mundane stuff doesn't matter at all, you know? And even, you know, and I agree with you, Andre, they're, you know, they have the long distance view for you. They're holding that in sacred trust for you. And you have to trust them because they have that view. And the same with the Father and the same with Jesus, right? We can't see that far down the road, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Maybe as we grow spiritually, and I think as we grow spiritually, we will be able to see more.
we will be able to see mm-hmm. farther down the road. We'll have greater insight mm-hmm. and greater foresight mm-hmm. as we grow spiritually. Mm-hmm. But for now, we've
yes.
got to trust
as
them
mm-hmm.
that they know that they have the long-distance view. And,
you know, there's a short passage that connects up the earlier conversation we were having about hearing the divine voice. It's interesting. And what we're talking about now, which is sort of how little we can perceive of what these remarkable beings, these ancient angels and the perfect the divine fragment. And it's 10952. And they say, it is sometimes possible to have the mind illuminated, to hear the divine voice that continually speaks within you, so that you may become partially conscious of the wisdom, truth, goodness, and beauty of the potential personality constantly indwelling you.
Mm. That's beautiful, that's Marvin.
Isn't that a gorgeous sentence?
Mm-hmm.
I'll read it again. It is sometimes possible to have the mind illuminated, to hear the divine voice that continually speaks within you.
Continually
mm-hmm. speaks within you, so that you may become partially conscious of the wisdom, truth, goodness, and beauty of the potential personality constantly indwelling you.
The potential personality.
Yeah. Wow.
That's a good one.
Mm.
You know, what a
great conversation today.
I know. Is that Chuck trying to come in? Because you're breaking up a little bit. I think it might be Chuck.
You might need to recall in, Chuck.
Yeah, you're breaking up a little bit, Chuck, or maybe move to a different part of the house.
Oh, maybe,
there you
maybe
are.
You're...
That's better.
There you are. You seem to be good now.
Better?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
I just moved the phone.
You're good.
Yeah. No, I was just saying, in what you were just reading, there's a description of a mutual becoming going on.
Yeah.
Our partnership
true.
Of our soul with our adjuster. Adjuster is also coming, in a sense. You know, they get better at being adjusters. They learn. But we're also becoming under the influence of the adjuster. So there's that mutual dependence on each other is just so, I don't know, kind of divine in the sense of affection
so
and love and partnership and collaboration that's wrapped up in that.
I like that idea, Chuck, of mutually becoming. How beautiful that is, because that speaks of a betrothal. I have something to give you. You have something to give me back. It's a true union.
Yes, you know, that's the essence of the Trinity right there.
There you go.
There it is.
Because the threeness remembers unity.
Yeah.
And it shows us that we're not separate from the rest of the universe. I mean, it's like we're braided. We're braided into the universe. Yes.
Mm.
Interwoven.
Wow. I love that.
Think of all the relationships that evolve just during one human lifetime and how that then will just continue in the next life. I mean, that's sort of that braiding.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. I like that image. Because we're all wound up in each other,
I got to tell you, Pam, why that's so poignant to me right now, because I had a dream the other night that Jesus was braiding my hair.
Oh.
And it did. It just slayed me, because I woke up thinking, I know there's a metaphor in here somewhere.
Oh.
And I'll tell you what came to me, but your analogy and Chuck too, that we're being braided into reality, is that it takes hair a while to grow, and I can't ever braid my own hair. It never gets long. I've been thinking about, I wish it was long enough to braid. So that probably plays into the dream. But then the time that it takes for hair to grow is you have to be patient. But then you can't braid it yourself oftentimes. And So somebody gets to braid it for you. And what an intimate,
nice,
loving act that is when someone braids,
nice,
your hair for you. Or I was watching my little granddaughter comb and braid her mother's hair, and I thought, gosh, that feels so good when a little child,
mm,
brushes your hair and touches you in the loving way like that. But then I thought, later, several days after the dream, I thought, wow, I bet Jesus actually did braid his sister's hair.
Good.
Yeah, it's a very loving, brotherly thing to do. And as,
mm,
I said, I've been thinking,
yes,
of it more. It, from these studies of the Eternal Son has brought that home to me more than ever before. The Master is a brother and the Eternal Brother. You know, the Eternal Son is the Eternal Brother. And so that brotherly love of just that simple act of braiding someone's hair for them because they can't do it for themselves. And, you know, made me feel like such a little sister. That's a good feeling. That was really a good feeling.
You braided Mary's,
yeah,
Mary's hair.
Yeah, right. So that idea to braid, that's, you know, that's, I often think of, you know, how the book talks about the threefold fluctuation of light. And how that signifies the deity's hearts are content, right, satisfied with the love of all the inhabitants of paradise.
There
shows the threefold fluctuation of light, and I see that as a braid. It's interesting. I always see it in my mind's eye as a braid. Yeah.
Mm. Interesting.
Three becomes
Yeah.
I wonder if that threefold
fluctuation. This is Kurt Sierra's rope. All over again,
it's
too.
It's the rope. There you go. It's
the rope.
Yeah. The braiding makes it stronger, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Religion
the
of personal
is
experience.
Right. Yeah.
In a braid. Goodness.
Yeah.
About the threefold fluctuation reminds me, again, in the section we just read, they talk about the envelopment. How the...
Yeah, enshrouding.
The deities, and one enshrouds the other.
Yeah.
That's why the fluctuation is threefold.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The contributions from each of them.
Shroud
each other.
I'm with Marvin. What a great conversation, you guys. Thanks for going
there.
These places. You know, to me, if you let the spirit flow as you read these wonderful, marvelous teachings, it will take you to the most amazing places. And they may not seem like they're relevant to what you're reading, but they really are. It's the way that it flows that just takes you on a journey. Just one paragraph can do that. One sentence can do that from this book. So precious, so amazing.
You know,
what
and process
feast.
Is so much. Yes, process is so much a part of this third person of Trinity, and we just touched on it. We just touched on it. I think the rest of the papers are going to explain the unfolding of that process. And, you know how we are intertwined within it.
Yeah.
The spirit
There's
of divine
the
ministry
again.
Is next. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. There's the spirit of divine ministry.
Oh, you're breaking up again, Chuck. So we're down to our last minute anyway.
So, yeah. But, yeah, next week. Thanks, Andre. Section 4, the spirit of divine ministry. Wow. That has to be delicious to dive into.
It will be.
Yeah. And I just want to say thanks to all of our listeners on the board. Man, it was so great to see you guys today. God's gumshoe. So good to see you, man. Miss you.
Yeah.
And, wow, I hope you are well. And Gary and Bob, John, and Snowman James. So good
and
to
Isadora.
See you guys. Yeah, and Isadora, our precious Isadora. So, wow, we love you guys. You keep us going. And all of our listeners on the archive, we love and appreciate you. Thank you for the great compliments you give us and, you know, for acknowledging us when you get a chance to say, yeah, I listen to you guys. Thank you. It means a lot.
Yes.
It means a lot. But, you know, we get as much out of it, probably more. And we enjoy it immensely. So, Thanks for giving us that privilege. And we love you guys. I love you all. Have a wonderful week.
Yes. Have a great week, everybody. Good conversation.
All right.
And wonderful to be with
for
you
now.
Guys.
Yeah.
Love you, folks.
Right. Love you.
Love you, too.
Adios.
Bye for now.
Bye for now.
You guys.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.